So that's the reality of the moment. The coronavirus outbreak has changed society greatly in a short amount of time, and the effects will linger for quite some time. We're essentially being asked to pull together while staying apart. Our separation from each other, though, predates the social distancing of the moment. Many people report feeling lonely, often despite having all kinds of friends in quote marks, on social media. The parallel trends are explored in a book by Val Walker called 400 Friends and No One to Call, Breaking Through Isolation and Building Community. Val Walker is a rehabilitation counselor and consultant. She helps people living with chronic illness, disability, grief, and trauma. She blogs for Psychology Today and is the author of a previous book, The Art of Comforting. Val lives in Boston and I presume joins us from there. Val Walker, welcome.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Good to have you. You point out the strangeness of starting this book by praising solitude, but that is where you take us.
Right. There was a period where I lived in Maine and really loved my quiet time in nature. And even though I worked as a mental health professional, I loved being isolated in lots of ways because I was a writer and I liked to have long times by myself. But as I got into my later 50s, I began to see I needed to do a lot more to build more support in my life.
Let me come back to the isolation part, though, because the solitude sounds like the way you write it in the book. It was an assertion of you, separate from
yes.
the people you had allowed to walk over you for a lot of years.
That's right. And really that part about me being in solitude is the introduction to my book, because I wanted to set it up that I had been so caught up and enmeshed in people's lives for decades. And so when I got into my later 40s, I said, you know, I'm going to tune everybody out for a while. I'm going to live and try to find my own inner voice, myself again. You know, I just felt like I had to get rid of all the noise in my head, you know. And long story made short, I realized that my time in Maine was going to be limited as I saw that I needed people more.
So, yeah, after 14 years semi-reclusive in Maine, you're back in Boston, but you know, obviously things have changed since the last time you were there. You looked for a book to help with your situation, and what were you finding?
Well, I really didn't find any books for my situation, and honestly, the situation that really sparked me to look for a book to help me, and when I realized I was really in my own kind of crisis, was I had surgery, and I was had lined up a couple of friends. I did have a few very close friends in Maine, and I lined up a couple of them to help me take me home from my surgery, which was a hysterectomy, and it was pretty involved, and I thought my friend was going to show up and pick me up, and also another friend was going to help take care of me, you know, for a couple of days, because I live alone, and my family wasn't around, and for basically, I was lying in the hospital bed, you know, with an IV around me, and I got a text message the very next morning after my surgery, and it had a message saying, sorry, family emergency, can't help you today.
Wow.
And it was a friend who, I didn't know this at the time, but her daughter had been in a car accident, and also she had other members in her family who had an opioid addiction, and there was a lot going on with chaos in her life. And other friends of mine were too strapped to help me out. So here I was, I had been a professional counselor, and I did have friends and colleagues, I thought, but when it came right down to it, I was incredibly stranded. And the hospital still made me, you know, discharged me, even though I didn't have anybody to take care of me.
You actually spent the night in the hospital lobby, didn't you?
Well, most of it. Somebody, a friend of a friend's daughter, finally showed up, and I ended up, it's just, it's what got me started, realizing that, my God, I'm so much more isolated than I thought I was. You know, before I thought, oh, I can handle most things, I've got somebody to turn to, but that was really what opened my eyes, and that's what got me started with this book, saying, you know, I'm going to write about this. I can't find a book for people who are abandoned like this.
Well, and you're not you're not alone in your aloneness, I guess is the gist of what I was about to say. But the point being that, as you point out in the book, the National Science Foundation says that the number of Americans with no close friends has roughly tripled since 1985.
Absolutely. Yes. And you know what was a comfort for me? Even though I was feeling, first of all, really ashamed of myself for not having people to turn to. Like, what was wrong with me that people would no-show on me like that? So I first, and this was a big part of writing my book, was looking at the shame and stigma of being lonely, being alone, being without social support, being without people to turn to. It was enormously shameful in me. And I was shocked at that because I had been a counselor who had helped people with mental illness or disabilities who had been shunned and judged by others, who felt alone and isolated. I thought, you know, I thought they had it worse than I did. But I realized, boy, I have to use a lot of the things I did to help them with myself. And it started with having some compassion for that shame and also reading research. When I started finding on AARP, because I was up in my 50s then, on the AARP website, there were studies on loneliness and isolation, and it was actually comforting for me to read statistics and see I wasn't alone and see this was an epidemic and look at the forces that were isolating me and stop just blaming myself or just blaming other people who had let me down. I said, you know, there's a bigger picture here. So thanks for letting me tell that piece of the story.
Sure. It is a nasty feedback loop, though, from the sounds of it, that, you know, people feel ashamed for feeling lonely, you know?
Right. It's very common. Apparently, my feelings were very normal, but boy, did I feel abnormal at the time.
All right. We'll come back and talk about what happened when you got to Boston and began to get back into a place where there are more people around, but still didn't know many of them. Val Walker's book is called 400 Friends and No One to Call, Breaking Through Isolation and Building Community. It's not all about social media, but it gets in there too. You can be assured of that. We'll come back and talk more with Val. You can join the conversation by phone and email. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. So, Val, you got to Boston when you decided that Maine was getting a little too lonely for you. Felt isolated, right, though, early in the job there. What changed things? Right. What were some of the icebreakers there?
Well, first of all, just being brand new there, I had been there for just 4 weeks where I was working as a case manager, working with families who had children with disabilities, doing that kind of work. And, my gosh, it wasn't a good fit, this first job I had in Boston. And, you know, part of the reason I left Maine also was that my job had been cut too. So I was in financial crisis as well as feeling really lonely. So I will say I had to have that job. So I was working just 1 month, and there was a particular coworker who really seemed to gossip a lot about me and seemed to not believe that I could do the job. And I avoided her. And it was this real struggle for 4 weeks. I had more social anxiety on the job. I was nervous. And I have an illness called colitis that was acting up, so I wasn't feeling well. I was nervous wreck, basically, at my job. So that said, suddenly the Boston Marathon bombing happened just 1 month after I'd been on this new job, just a month after I'd moved to Boston. And we were out for a few days because the city got locked down. Then we went back to work. And the day we returned to work, there was just a few people at work. And this particular woman named Pat was there just staring at the wall in her office. And I avoided her at first, thinking, well, she doesn't want to talk to me. But she really looked upset, you know. And I just thought, maybe it's okay just to check in and see how she's doing after this bombing. So it turned out her son had been there at the marathon and had witnessed his friend actually get blown up and had lost a limb and had ended up in Mass General Hospital. And Pat just told me, you know, because she was appreciative that I asked how she was doing, she just started talking and told me about her son, how worried she was about her son, and that he needed to get to the hospital and show up for his friend. And her son was just devastated. It had been really traumatic. And so we talked, and somehow just her opening up and talking with me just brought me out of my shell, out of my fears, out of my isolation. And, you know, something I said to her, which came from my experience of lying in that hospital bed in Maine, like I told you, being stranded,
sure,
without telling her about what happened to me, I simply said, there's nothing worse than lying in that bed and no one shows up. Nothing worse. And Pat said, you know, it's awful if people don't give a rat's ass about you. That's what she said. I've got to talk to my son. I'm really going to push for this and try to get him to the hospital and go see his friend. You're right. So lo and behold, a few days later, Pat came up to me and said, you know what? He went to see his friend and he didn't know what to say. You know, he didn't know what to do. He just hugged his friend, and his friend introduced him to other friends of his who had also been injured in the blast. And her son made friends with other people right there at the hospital. And it just opened her son up, too, that you don't have to know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, Boston Strong doesn't mean you have to be strong to reach out. So that's how I found a way to say, you know, Val, saying to myself, if you care enough, if you're curious enough, if you're interested enough in somebody, it'll pull you out of your fear. So that was a big step for me to realize by caring. And sometimes you have to give support to get support.
Well, that is something that really comes through in the book. I mean, and I'm really jumping ahead to part three of the book. It's divided into several sections, but the pattern emerges after a while. You give what you hope to get.
Right. And you find people who've been isolated by the same things you are. Like when her son went to the hospital and saw these other people who had been traumatized by the blast, well, they bonded together. And I began to find with the people I interviewed and profiled in the later part of my book, that was a common theme. We find the people who've been isolated by the same thing we are. And guess what? What isolates us can be turned into what unites us.
Ah, that is a big one. Val Walker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is 400 Friends and No One to Call, Breaking Through Isolation and Building Community. So you list a whole bunch of myths in the book about social isolation, Val. It seems like many of these are variations of it's your fault.
Yeah, variations of your fault, thinking you had some character flaw, something was wrong with you, that people are, you know, not showing up in your life. What did I do? There's a lot of reasons in our society, also myths, you might say, that we believe if you don't have the support in your very close family members or your closest friends, if it's not coming from your closest circle, then maybe there's something wrong with them or something wrong with you. But I found out in the wider community, there's really just say it takes a village. It's not just up to a particular family member or one or two of your best friends. Right now, and at that time in my life, the big similarity with that crisis in my life and what's going on with coronavirus now is we're realizing it takes a village, and we've got to get out of just thinking of our own tribe and our own. I was trying to rely on just two friends back in 2012 to help me after my surgery, and that wasn't enough of a safety net. I wish I had invested in building a wider support network. So when I was in Boston, I started going to support groups. I started volunteering and finding ways to meet people and connect with people in a meaningful way and getting to know people over time, like on a volunteer job or you know, especially if you go to a support group, and I went to one for people who have colitis and Crohn's disease, who have this, you know, disease, and boy, did we have a lot in common, because socially having diseases like that, you can probably imagine it causes problems socializing. So I found a lot of help, and I built friendships through support groups, through volunteering and common interests. So there was a lot I thought that could apply on a practical way.
Yeah.
For people in the book.
Well, you had to learn a lot, and you ultimately had to write your own book, because you pointed out there wasn't one available in this sort of realm. Now, there, your book includes a couple of lists of questions for people to use to consider their attitudes toward people who are alone, and there's another set of lists about life in the digital age. I got to the end reading both those lists and wondered whether people in relationships just don't think about being lonely, if it just sort of sneaks up on people, if they, you know, lose a spouse or some major figure in your life, and all of a sudden, whoops.
Right. What kind of people are isolated out there that are like invisible reasons for them being isolated? A lot of times people can have an illness, but they don't look sick. A lot of times people can be, well, I'll tell you some of the most isolated people out there, which can be in just about any age group. Cigna studies have shown this, Connect to Effect studies. I can tell you from lots of sources, and I'll boil it down. First of all, one out of four Americans lives alone, and one out of three senior Americans lives alone. That's a big force. When you're involved with caregiving in a real intense way for someone who's sick or has a disability, you're very isolated. Also, people who are isolated by grief or loss have lost loved ones. That's a big reason. Other reasons are socioeconomic, and that's really what I write a lot about in my book, what I call survival mode, and this affects millennials a lot, too, is like you're so strapped. You know, you have huge financial burdens on you, and you might put your social life on your back burner because you're so busy just trying to survive and work maybe lots of jobs, maybe gig jobs, you know, getting by, trying to survive. And it's double that if you have an illness and you're trying to survive and work. Double that if you're, you know, older. So there are lots of factors that isolate us. And I thought it was really good in healing for people to identify what are the factors that isolate me. And take a good look at that, because that can, you can take a problem-solving approach. So I hope that people can stop blaming themselves or each other and look at the picture of what are these forces that are isolating not just you, but lots of people in the same boat as you.
Val Walker, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called 400 Friends and No One to Call, Breaking Through Isolation and Building Community. You just heard it. One in four Americans lives alone. One in three seniors lives alone. And it's happening to millennials, too. Join the conversation on the Exchange. Talk about ways in which you find community or ways in which you hope to find community. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to the story about Becky, who was supposed to pick you up from the hospital. That's what you call it in the book anyway. You mentioned that there really was a crisis in her life. So she was feeling isolated too. You were persistent enough to try to keep a contact with her, and you finally had a real conversation.
Yeah. And that's a message that I put out there to people who feel, you know, for whatever reason, you know, abandoned or isolated by your friends. Sometimes it's because they're just as isolated as you are in their situation. And it took me 3 years of checking in with her. And it's just because basically I didn't want to give up on her. And it turns out she had had a stroke and she had found herself overwhelmed. She had a fairly mild stroke. She was in her 50s. And she just couldn't do all the things. She couldn't keep up with everything anymore. And she had a couple of stepchildren living at home who were recovering from addictions. And her, you know, her husband was dealing with financial stress. I mean, she was really in her own isolated situation. And it really took me really showing up. And pretty much she finally one day was able to pick up the phone and talk with me, and it was a wonderful reunion. And I had thought all that time she had judged me or thought I had done something wrong, or I was really afraid she thought I was too needy, like, mm-hmm. Oh, my God, you know, like maybe I did something that pushed her away. But it turned out she so welcomed me reaching out to her, and she felt so ashamed that she had kind of hidden from me. She just didn't feel like she could return the friendship after she had the stroke and after those kids were having so many problems.
Now, there's a self-check in here for all of us. What are the three S's we need to watch out for?
Oh, Thank you for asking that. I really noticed a pattern. One of the biggest things is shame, feeling ashamed for whatever reason. That can really isolate us if there's something that we're ashamed of. Also, stigma. Stigma is definitely, let's just say, if you feel like there's something you're not able to talk about, even with people that love you, even with people you're close to, that's why loneliness can happen, even if you have close people in your life. If it's something that's happened to you and you feel like you shouldn't burden them or talk about it, or it's just not okay to talk about it, that's stigma. You know, it's really something you may end up having to find another helping professional or maybe someone else to talk about in a support group or something. But it might not be a friend you can talk to. So stigma can get in the way. Shame can get in the way. And also status. You know, you feel like, well, I'm not qualified to be there for that person. They've got a better job than I do. They make a lot more money than I do. There were a lot of friends who were baby boomers my age who were making more money, going off to, you know, holidays and trips to Bali or whatever. Of course, this is all before the coronavirus.
Yeah.
But I was really feeling inferior to them because I earned so much less money than they did. And I just didn't feel like they could relate to my situation when my car broke down or something, or I was sick and I couldn't afford my medications, you know. So there are reasons, I think, when we compare ourselves to others, which is easy to do on social media, it's huge. It can really isolate us. And the shame of, you know, just feeling like something might be wrong with you. Maybe you would be more popular and get more likes from people if you were doing great, but there must be something that's causing people not to say that they like you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the three S's that can be really toxic in our system and make us isolate more.
All right. Well, I want to talk certainly about social media and how it can exacerbate this. Let's take a call here, though. Howard in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Val Walker, the author of 400 Friends and No One to Call.
Yeah, thanks. I'm thinking a big part of the reason why I've been feeling isolated most of my life, aside from having a neurological disability, is that I was basically interested in a lot of things that a lot of other people I knew were not interested in, and they were interested in things that I was not interested in. Like a lot of people, like when I was going through the school system, the students with me were into pop culture trends and fads that I had no natural inclination for, and so and what I did have a natural inclination for, they didn't, and so I had nothing in common with them. So I really didn't, get together with them very often.
But you've done some outreach. I mean, Howard, you run No Shame Theater still, don't you?
I performed in it. Running it is something quite different.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. Even there, it seems that the one and only thing I have in common with them is that we all perform together and create sketches for us to perform together in. And I have other interests outside of that, and I really don't have that many other people. Mm-hmm. Who are interested in what I'm interested in. I have one relative who's interested in one of the things I'm interested in.
Okay, let's get Val in here to get some ideas.
Well, first of all, I'm really impressed. It sounds like you created something, right, where you were, like I said, giving support and maybe finding some people out there that had some things in common with you. Is that what you're saying, this theater? You had a theater that you created?
Well, it's kind of more of a, like a amateur talent show kind of thing.
Did you meet people doing that? That even one person by doing that who you could talk to at least some?
Usually only during the actual, like, we have workshop rehearsals and like between performances. We have like a first Friday of the month performance. And so, other than that, I haven't really been able to find that many other people. I have also belonged to another group called Mind Freedom International, which has a local franchise in mm-hmm. Eugene. And I did talk to some people in there for a while, but usually only when we got together at meetings and at local events.
All right, so let's focus on that then, and thank you, Howard, for calling. Val, I mean, so how do people move out from places where they get together in assemblies that are scheduled and then turn that into something else?
Right. Well, I wanted to say, now this was before the coronavirus, sure. But let's just hold the thought. Pre-coronavirus, what I would have suggested is create a social opportunity after you guys have gotten together doing your activity together, right? Have a follow-up. Have a way to meet up just to socialize when you finish, even if it's just over a meal. Like even sitting down for 30 minutes after those guys all got together. Mm-hmm. See, even sharing a pizza or something. Like you can create ways to get together with the people you're connecting with. You sometimes just be proactive and be like a host and invite people to something. So you can create like your own meetup if you like, where you invite people to things. It's not just to do a certain activity together, but you can socialize and hang out after that. So that's just one example.
All right,
a lot of the most isolated people I knew were creating their own meetups.
Okay, we have to take a break here. Howard, thank you so much for your call. Always good to hear from you. Val Walker is the author of 400 Friends and No One to Call. Back on The Exchange in 1 minute. So let's go a little harder at the social media issue here, because it does cut a couple of ways. Let's talk about it first as divider, because it does seem like we hear this a lot, where, you know, you have 400 friends and yet there's no one person you can say, hey, can you get me at the airport, or can you get me from the hospital or whatever?
Right. Well, I do want to bring this into the coronavirus crisis that we're in right now and social distancing, because some of the ways we can use social media can actually be to unite with each other. So even though social media can be a way to divide us, to make us feel left out, you know, FOMO, fear of missing out, social media can make us compare ourselves to others, and it can also become sort of a habit. Lonely people are more likely to fall down kind of a downward spiral of depending too much on social media. That said, with the coronavirus going on and social distancing now, I believe we can still use social media to connect in a deep way, but as long as we follow up with real live phone calls and Skyping so that we have real-time conversations. We might use social media to stay in touch and plan to get together, but we can get together through the phone, having real conversations, and Skyping is wonderful. And we can also reach out to people we haven't been in touch with for a long time. This is a perfect opportunity during this social distancing time to get closer to each other, even if it is by phone or Skyping or other ways we can reach out with good old-fashioned ways, like writing letters, making things to show we care about them. We can make things. We can create things like photo albums, or we can make beaded jewelry, or we could make things that with our hands to give to one another, too, in these times if we can't see them in person. So there are ways of reaching out even during these times. Where we use social media, we put the heart and soul back into our devices. We can put ourselves, and we can share stories on websites, for example, where we can talk about real things going on and not just superficial stuff. So I want to say some of the people I profiled in my book, especially who were millennials, they use social media a lot to get connected, but then they followed up with real time or FaceTime or, you know, meetings of some kind where they could have real-life conversations. And sharing our stories is so important. What are you going through? How are you holding up? Tell me what's, you know, and listening really, really well. So I'm just saying social media can be one or the other, and we have a choice to use social media in a way to keep us together.
That really comes through loud and clear in the book, though, the point of having real-time conversations. And that's how you and Becky were finally able to patch things up,
right.
is a chance to hear each other's voices at the same time and not be sitting there waiting for the little thing that says so-and-so is typing.
Right. And voice does amazing things. If we can't touch people with our hands and be there in person, we can just, even when you Skype and you can see somebody's facial expression and you can hear their voice, you know, it does just wonderful things to keep us feeling connected, and it's so much deeper and more meaningful than just posting things. But sometimes you have to post things just to get the conversation started.
Mm-hmm.
But then comes all these other layers and layers over time where we can build a relationship.
And you mentioned this already with millennials using social media to help in finding people to connect with in the real world. You also mentioned meetup.com and
yes.
Happy Geeks of Greater Boston.
I know. Yeah, there's some great meetups. There are all kinds of creative names. So there was one called I Want Regular Conversation Meetup. So there are people out there starving to meet other people. But right now, during this time, I think we can find lots of people. As the gentleman who was just speaking with us, he found people through his... He was actually very brave and putting out his own creative things. And I think if he just allowed these kinds of things to go on for a while where people could grow a relationship over time, and if he might have included some way to hang out or have a meal and sort of socialize around that activity, I think he could have generated a couple of new friendships over time. But the point is, in our day and age, we forget that it takes time. You know, it's not instant.
Right.
We don't make friends or meet our partners instantly. And I hope during this time of social distancing, we can put the time in and the focus in to building relationships, just showing your interest. And God, do people need to be listened to right now. There's so much on our minds to share. So
right.
Find your long-lost cousin or your long-lost high school classmate from 20 years ago. Go through your memorabilia and whatever in your closet, and you might find some stuff from people and go, gosh, you know what? I haven't talked to them in years. And you might just rediscover a wonderful new friendship.
We have an email here from Philip, no town given, who asks, what about when older introverted couples who don't have immediate family get isolated?
You mean introverted couples together?
Yes.
Who don't have... I still think introverts can use social media or video. For example, sharing with your loved ones. If you don't feel like having lots of chats and talking and putting out energy and conversation, you know what? Just showing your interest by saying, you know, here's some of my favorite movies that have cheered me up at this time. I want to share some movies with you. Find sort of those things you can share that are common interests, movies, music, playlists, good books, even just talking about stuff that's keeping you going and keeping you inspired. So I hope that makes sense, just sharing the things that have helped you cope and sharing resources as well. So even if you don't have that heart-to-heart conversation because you're kind of introverted and don't want a big conversation, share your interests in things that might inspire or cheer up people that you care about. I see a lot of that going on, and it's very, very heartening for people to, you know, get a video clip from Italy, where everybody's singing from the balcony.
Right.
Or, oh, here's my playlist of my happy songs, or here's my pictures of my dog, or, you know, doing that kind of cheering up with even if it's not a direct conversation, there are other ways to share.
Right. Yeah, I had a Facebook friend who put something up about, you know, okay, list all your songs that are about being lonely.
Yeah.
So even though it was like all by myself and stuff like that, the songs that will make people sit in their cars and cry,
right,
it still got laughs out of other people, I think.
Right. Humor is wonderful, too, right now. Good jokes. Go for it.
Let's see, another question here. I wanted to ask about the 15 stories in part 3 of the book. First of all, how did you make the connections to find the people to tell the stories?
Well, you know, one of the things I did to volunteer when I was super lonely when I first moved to Boston, it's a long story, but I found a way to write for a blog for a doctor who has a beautiful storytelling website because she believed her patients healed better when they could tell their stories. And this particular doctor, and I'm very happy to say, Annie Brewster, is herself has multiple sclerosis. And she found that setting up a website for people to share stories was really healing. And she shared her stories, too. And she had social workers who worked with her do interviews and podcasts with patients and people telling their stories. So I wanted to blog for her, and I offered to write for her, write a regular blog and interview people. she needed people to help interview other, I would say, other healthcare workers in the community and other patients, other people writing, other authors, leaders in their community. So I started being sort of her own interviewer for her blog. So I started meeting all these people who told stories about breaking out of an isolating experience. So many of the people I found for the book were for writing on Dr. Brewster's blog for the Health Story Collaborative site. I should really give a shout out to the Health Story Collaborative website, because that helped me build community. And before I knew it, I found all these people who wanted to be in my book. I didn't design it that way, but a lot of them had enjoyed the interviews and being on the blog and telling their stories. I said, well, why not come on and join this group book project?
So I want to talk about support networks, and you describe them as emotional, affiliative, tangible, and knowledge networks. But I noticed that with all of these, there's maintenance in here. You do things to maintain connections all the time. You don't just wait for crisis to reach out.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, that's why doing something like volunteering or taking a class that meets over a long period, even if we do it with a webinar these days. But when you're with a group of people where you're either volunteering or you're going to, say, a class, or you're doing a study group, or you have a writing group, or, you know, when you get a group going, the beauty of it is you get to know each other over time. And by doing that, we can really build connections that last. Like I say, it takes a long time to build the trust of somebody and build that friendship.
Well, then that's a really excellent point, though, because I noticed that when we talk about, you know, confiding, for example, loneliness to another person, that you need to modulate it. Don't expect everything out of a new friend in the first 20 minutes.
Right.
You will scare them away.
These are all ways that I did in the book are sort of bridges into your community, the different ways you can help in your community and build relationships. Say one of the sections is hands-on support. Well, there are ways, for example, for hands-on support, we can give it and get it by offering to help our neighbors around us. Maybe we can buy some toilet paper and sanitizer and find a way to put it on their doorstep for them. Or there are ways around where you can help out hands-on. Maybe some people need help with their child care needs. There might be a way safely that you can help each other with that. So hands-on support. Then there's also emotional support. And I really want to make a big shout-out that it's really good to have emotional support in these very changeable times where we're all confused and uncertainty makes us feel really insecure. The changes going on, we often feel abandoned by, you know, it's a very, very unusual time. And we're going to need probably most of us at least one person we can talk to. And if it's not a friend or a family member, you don't have somebody real close to talk to, maybe there's a long-lost person out there somewhere that you remember from years ago that you can reach out to. But also, I want to put it out there that there are some very important lines you can call on the phone, like 211 is all around the country if you're looking for somebody to talk to on the phone, a helpline, a crisis line. You don't have to always be alone. You can talk to someone if you can't find someone. Sometimes we're just going to have to release some of those worries and fears and the upset. We need a person to share that with. So I can't bring that home enough in this time. We might not be the person that's handling all the stuff along with you. You might have to reach out and find somebody outside of your circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is important because, you know, we're just the things that we would normally do to go people watch or something are not necessarily good places to be or go now. Yeah, so the chance for isolation seems that much greater. So we're just getting started. What are you going to watch for and how people respond to the crisis?
Well, I do want to make sure people also know a lot of therapists and counselors are offering what's called teletherapy. In other words, they're doing more therapy by phone and Skype. So if you think you might want a counselor, just remember there's a lot going on, especially now, for people to talk to through phone or Skype. Same with doctors, telehealth, more more telehealth services where you can talk to people without having to see them in person. So the disaster relief government number is really important to remember through. It's a government mental health line.
Mm-hmm.
Substance use and mental health. Don't think you have to have a substance use problem, but it's the website for that with the phone number. And I just want you to know mental health is a big piece to a nationwide phone number. I can give it out if you want.
Yeah, we just got a couple seconds.
Okay.
Do you have it?
Yes. 1-800-985-5990. It's the SAMHSA.gov website, SAMHSA.gov.
Okay.
And they will link you up with a person to talk to or even help you find a local therapist.
All right. Val Walker, 400 friends and no one to call. Thank you so much. That's today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day. Mm-hmm.